I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Maris is our guest this hour. David's latest book is Once in a Great City, a Detroit Story. We'll tell you what the inspiration was. It has to do with football and watching the Green Bay Packers in February of 2011 and seeing a commercial that came on television that actually reminded him of his childhood, because he was born in Detroit and lived about 6.5 or 7 years there. Detroit in 1963 is where this book is centered. It's a little more than a one-year period of time, but it seemed, as he writes, to be on top of the world. The city's leaders, the grandson of the first Ford, influential and highly interesting labor leader Walter Reuther, the founder of Motown, Berry Gordy. Motown was just getting going in a big way in Detroit at this time. The Reverend C.L. Franklin, his involvement in the civil rights movement, and of course his daughter Aretha, Governor George Romney, who was very progressive on civil rights issues. The auto industry was selling more cars than ever before. People were being able to buy homes, and things seemed to be on the move, but there were always these issues, particularly of race and segregation and people moving out of the city to suburbs. And you could see that starting to happen at this time as well. David is a terrific writer. He's associate editor at the Washington Post. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who won the prize for national reporting in 93 for his paper's coverage of presidential candidate Bill Clinton. He's author of First in His Class, a biography of Bill Clinton, Rome 1960, The Olympics That Stirred the World, Barack Obama, The Story, Clemente, The Passion and Grace of Baseball's Last Hero, They Marched into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967, and When Pride Still Mattered, A Life of Vince Lombardi. Well, welcome phone calls. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and Twitter is at K Dunn Show. Hi, David. Thanks for talking with us again.
Kathleen, always great to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So I love this story. You're watching the Green Bay Packers in Manhattan, and this commercial comes on the air. I think I cried when I saw it, too, and I don't have any ties with Detroit.
Not only was I watching the Packers Super Bowl, but I was watching it with the cast of the Lombardi Broadway play.
Oh, were you really?
For real, yeah.
Oh, my.
and I noticed that freeway sign that said Detroit, and that's what caught my interest, and then I started getting hooked on the commercial and really teared up almost watching it. My wife sort of said, come on, you know, they're just trying to sell cars, and Detroit's a mess. Why are you falling for this? But it really got me thinking about what Detroit meant to me and what it meant to this whole country.
Mm-hmm. And you spent, what, about 6.5 years there?
Yeah, I was born in Women's Hospital, lived in three different places in Detroit as a very young person with my parents and big brother and sister, moved out of Detroit in 1956. Mm-hmm. One of my earliest vivid memories is sitting on the porch of our flat on Dexter Avenue in 1955 and having my big brother and sister quiz me on the 1955 new model cars as they drove down the street.
Do you still know your cars, David?
No, I'm not guy at all.
Oh, no.
No, I mean, I can't. I don't know what's under a hood, but I still love to write about it.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about this particular year, some of the cast of characters that you write about are truly extraordinary people, and the fact that they were there and there were reasons for them being there in the labor movement and the head of civil rights movements, and of course in the Motown, it made it what it was in those years, partly because of those people and people coming to Detroit to sing and to work in the labor movement and to make a decent living, right?
Yeah, it's really extraordinary what converged in Detroit during that era. And so all of the elements of what I wanted to write about were there. And not only were the themes there in terms of music and cars and labor and civil rights and the middle class, but these very vivid characters, you know, ranging from Walter Reuther, the United Auto Workers president, who I think is one of the great under-regarded figures of 20th century social history.
Mm-hmm.
To Berry Gordy, you know, the genius who created Motown, and all of the brilliant artists that he brought with him.
I'm glad you mentioned Reuther, because I thought that, well, that should be your next book, because he is a fascinating character, and I'd love to have you write about him at great length. Wouldn't he be fascinating? I know other people have, but you could really do him justice.
I do, but I think I gave him about what I'm going to. I've got other things that are obsessing me now, but it certainly was fun to study him and write about him, and you know, from the very beginning of his coming from West Virginia, the working class there, and getting involved at Ford Motor Company. At one point, one of the managers at Ford said he was a bright young man and maybe he'd be a vice president someday. And Reuther sort of thought, well, little do they know what I had in mind.
Yeah. I love your description here that Reuther spent much of his time contemplating the plight of man in the modern world, and when he thought, he wrote.
Yeah, you know, he really was very prescient in a lot of ways. In the book, you'll see he was trying to persuade both the federal government, when LBJ was first taking over as president, and the big three automakers to build smaller cars and to find ways to cooperate to save jobs. And he was also incredibly interested in the effects of technology on the workforce, and really predicted a lot of the troubles that would come in terms of eliminating jobs and sort of deadening the whole notion of working class jobs.
He also survived. There's a whole dark story to this city, as there are to many cities, but this assassination attempt, he was lucky he could live as long as he did, because people you write, both on the right and on the left, didn't like this guy very much.
Yeah, he was despised by the auto companies, for the most part, and the right wing, and also the United Auto Workers had a very strong communist element as well. And Reuther was against them too, so he was sort of in the middle of a socialist and certainly to the left. But when there was an assassination attempt, nobody was quite sure which side was trying to kill him. He also was more openly and visibly beaten up by Ford Motor Company goons twice. Once at his brother's apartment when they were having a birthday party, and another time on the overpass at Ford Motor Company when he was trying to organize there.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the migration to Detroit, because people from the South brought many gifts. They brought the gift of song and of storytelling, and were given the gift by some in the auto industry to make a pretty good living.
Yeah, Detroit, like Chicago and Cleveland and some other big industrial northern cities, truly benefited from the great migration of African Americans from Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia. And they did bring with them, as you said, the oral tradition of storytelling and song, and that was one of the roots of the making of Motown, in essence. They had jobs and single-family homes in Detroit. A lot of them were able to afford pianos, which was another factor in the development of music in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So there were so many different ways that Detroit influenced music, and music influenced Detroit.
Let's play a little music, because you have this great soundtrack that we were dancing to this morning in our offices.
It's impossible not to dance.
I know. I just love it. But here's
at least people our age.
Right. And here's a woman who did have one of those pianos in her house. So we'll listen to a little Motown during the course of this show, because why not? It's Detroit, 1963, after all. Martha Reeves, who I believe did have a piano in her house, right?
Oh, absolutely. And she grew up with that oral Southern tradition. Her family came up from Georgia. Her grandfather was a preacher. And she also benefited from those public school music teachers. She remembered every one of them that she had from elementary school on. And interviewing her was kind of a thrill for a lot of reasons. But one was that in the middle of the interview, she was talking about her high school music teacher and how he grilled them in the classics. And really, she started singing arias as a senior in high school. And then she broke into an aria while I was interviewing her. So I have it on tape.
Oh, David, that was a great moment. I know you've interviewed a lot of people, but that'll stay with you forever, won't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, another thing about Martha is she was on that first Motortown Review in 1962, October, that its first appearance was at the Howard Theater in Washington. And last year, at age 72, she came back to the Howard Theater, and she was still rocking. It was great.
Yeah. Another person, we think of Aretha, but certainly her father plays a very prominent role in your book. An interesting guy, kind of controversial in some ways, incredibly good-hearted man, and really out there, flamboyant, I think you call him at one point,
yeah.
C.L. Franklin. So let's hear his story. He was a preacher who went south, kind of did this roadshow thing for a long time.
Oh, it was incredible. He was a circuit flyer preacher who would take his three daughters, including Aretha, and other singers with him, and they would go into a city, and an arena would be booked. Maybe 10,000 people come out to hear him preach. People knew his sermons because they were on the radio all over the country, and also Chess Records had recorded them. So just like a great rock star, you know, when he'd go on stage, people would shout out what sermon they wanted to hear him preach. He was very flamboyant and not particularly highly regarded by the more conservative Baptist Ministerial Alliance in Detroit, was very effective during the period that I write about.
Mm-hmm. You say that people would come from the South during the migration and ask if anybody in town knew C.L. Franken and where to find him, and they'd get to his house, and he gave them money. He found him a place to stay.
Yeah, that's what his one of his daughters tells that story of people knocking on the door and her dad answering it and giving them some help. He was the preacher to the street people of Detroit, the prostitutes, the hustlers. They'd line up outside his church and listen to him on loudspeakers. And sometimes, you know, as many thousands of people were listening to his sermons at New Bethel Baptist Church.
Did he influence in terms of performing Aretha in any way? Was there something
musical?
Well, I
think so.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, I
no,
think he did. You know, the way he preached, one person described it that he would start humming partway through his sermon and then start preaching to the pitch of his hum. And the rhythms that he had were not unlike those that Aretha developed. So I think you very well can see the roots of Aretha's incredible soulful singing in the preaching of her father.
And he was making pretty good money.
Yeah, he was living sort of the high life. You know, he had a nice car and hanging out at the different clubs. But, you know, probably paltry compared to the mega church preachers of today. But in that era, he was very popular.
And a friend of Mahalia Jackson's, and she made a phone call to him and asked him to...
Well, Mahalia Jackson was a friend of Reverend Franklin's and also of Martin Luther King's. And this is the summer of 63, really the key summer of civil rights in the South. And Martin Luther King had been arrested, and the hoses and police dogs had been set upon he and his fellow civil rights protesters in Birmingham, Alabama. And Mahalia Jackson suggested that Franklin organize a fundraiser and rally in Detroit to help the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and King's people. And so he did. There was some dissension within the black leadership in Detroit on whether Franklin was the right person to lead this effort, but he did, and it turned out to be not only peaceful, but the largest civil rights rally in American history to that point. About 150,000 people walked down Woodward Avenue, the main thoroughfare of Detroit, just block after block of legions of people going down to ending up at the Cobo Hall, where Martin Luther King delivered the first variation of, or one of the early variations of his I Have a Dream speech.
Hmm. And wasn't there some controversy about whether or not, as there always tends to be in events like this, there should be white involvement, white organization as well, or should it be a black event?
Yeah, there was. This was 63. It was a little early, but the fissures that would develop within the African-American community about how much to rely on white leadership or help were starting to form then. And there was another minister in town, Reverend Clegg, who was on his way to becoming a black nationalist and really more in the Malcolm X camp than the Martin Luther King camp, who really didn't want any whites participating, any white leaders. And he tried to keep Walter Reuther and the progressive mayor of Detroit, Jerome Kavanaugh, out of any role in the march. That didn't happen, and Reuther did march arm-in-arm with King, and Reuther was very instrumental in the civil rights movement and pretty close to King. So it created a fissure that developed from there.
And you write about the UAW spending quite a bit of money to give to the civil rights movement, to get people bail in Birmingham, et cetera. How much money are we talking, and how substantial was it?
Well, it doesn't sound like much today, but it was a lot then. Mm-hmm. And really, the UAW helped bankroll the civil rights movement in that summer. It was over $100,000 to the civil rights movement and King in that period, and so much more in-kind contributions, really heavily involved both in bailing King's people out of jail in Birmingham, and then later in helping establish the March on Washington in August of that year.
So was there a substantial difference? I know there was, and you write about how King was greeted at the airport by the dignitaries
yes.
of the city, that he wouldn't encounter dogs or fire hoses in Detroit. Was there a marked difference in the way that he was treated in Detroit?
Oh, absolutely. And that's attributable largely to the police chief during that era, or the police commissioner, George Edwards, who was a progressive white man who had stepped down from the state Supreme Court to become the police commissioner with the sole purpose of trying to improve race relations in the city.
Hmm.
Edwards did greet King at the airport and essentially said, you'll encounter no police dogs here. You know, a reference to what happened with Bull Connor and the police in Birmingham, who essentially rioted against the African-American protesters. So there was a very sharp difference there, but you can't be naive about it. There still were many racial problems in Detroit that played themselves out later that very summer, sadly.
Yeah. We welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is David Marinus, and David's latest book is Once in a Great City, a Detroit Story. He is the author of, well, the Packers played yesterday, so When Pride Still Mattered, A Life of Vince Lombardi. I'm sure many of you have read that story. He's also, and we've interviewed him on First in His Class, A Biography of Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, The Story, Clemente, The Passion and Grace of Baseball's Last Hero, They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam and America, October 1967, and many other wonderful books. David is an associate editor at the Washington Post and lives in D.C. and also lives in Madison, so many of you are familiar with him. We're going to weave a little bit of Motown into our show, too, because you weave Motown into a show whenever you can, and that's not really often, so we want to bring ourselves back, and music will do that as well, to 1963. So we'll play a little music, pause a little while, play a little music, and return to David and your phone calls. Yeah, feel free to call us anytime you like. The lines are open. 800-486-8655 is the number.
Together, I'm
Lewis is our guest this hour, and he's the author of Once in a Great City, a Detroit Story. It concentrates a little bit before and a little after the year 1963. So we're thinking cars, we're thinking Motown, we're thinking progressive leadership, unions, decent living, etc. And David, in his wonderful research and wonderful way of writing, really takes us to that particular time. He grew up, well, for so many years, 6.5 or so, in Detroit. And we're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655. Sherry in Whitewater, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am originally from Detroit. I grew up at on 8.5 Mile Road, and I'm actually going back there this weekend for a class reunion.
Oh.
And I've read a couple of Mr. Moranis' books, and I love them, and I'm so excited to get my hands on this one and read about it, as, you know, because it's about Detroit.
I'm sorry, David, go ahead.
I said I'll be heading to Detroit tomorrow myself.
Oh.
It's a fun
place. Yeah, I'm leaving
right
Thursday
now.
Morning. We could have carpooled. Anyway. So thanks so much for writing this, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
And Sherry, before you go, are your memories fond of growing up in Detroit?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I was just on hold thinking 1963. I was 6. You know, it was a wonderful place to grow up. It was a wonderful time to grow up. I really believe that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks so much for your call. We've been playing a lot of Motown, and we can't do the hour without all the incredible talent that came from Detroit. And Berry Gordy, his family story is just remarkable, and what he was able to create during those years, also remarkable, David.
Oh, it really was. He started, it's sort of legendary. He got an $800 loan from his family to start Motown. The Berry family was very entrepreneurial, and all of the 8 brother siblings and their parents had a fund that they would contribute. Each would put in some money every month, and then they'd vote on where that money would go. And that's the money that Berry started to form Motown in 1959. And the talent that he was able to pull together is truly amazing. Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Marvin Gaye, little Stevie Wonder, who was 13 years old when he started there, Mary Wells, we heard her singing My Guy there, Martha and the Vandellas, the Supremes were just starting. They hadn't really hit yet in 63. It would be the next year when they would become big, along with the Temptations and then the Four Tops. Just an amazing, for anybody of our generation, it's really one of the key soundtracks of our lives.
Mm-hmm. And going back, I want you to spend a little more time on this about education, because you went back to Detroit and tried to find your old school and has some kind of sorry things, sad things to say about what you found. But you say that every musician that you talked to remembered, which I think is astounding, their earliest music teachers. They must have had one whale of a music program in Detroit.
Yeah, they really did. They had an amazing music program, and thousands and thousands of kids benefited from it. So the deterioration of the schools in Detroit took a long time, but now, you know, they're in pretty sorry state. During that era, they were excellent schools, you know. And every person I interviewed remembered their music teacher.
Hmm.
Music was a key component of the school system, as were the arts. Detroit had a great art museum as well, the Detroit Institute of Arts, which is still there and still has an amazing collection. So, you know, that whole artistic aspect of Detroit is kind of neglected because of people think of cars, but it had so much else going for it.
Mm-hmm.
As well.
The mural, is it still there, the Diego Rivera?
Oh, absolutely. It's on the walls. It's on all of the walls. It's several murals. And it is worth going to Detroit just to see it. You walk into the courtyard of the Detroit Institute of Arts, and there it is, and it's quite stunning.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the African American migration from the South. What about the migration from Appalachia? Poor whites coming to the city for the same reason poor blacks were coming to the city, and how those two cultures had some difficulties in getting along.
Sure, they both came for the same reasons and with the same interests and commonalities, and yet there was many difficulties resulting from that. going back to World War II, in 1943, there was a riot was sparked, and it was largely involving poor whites from Appalachia versus the African Americans in the city. And it was, at the time, it was the largest race riot in American history, and it was a fight over jobs and housing. Hmm. You know, the people who had the least fighting over what little they could get. You know, many hundreds were killed in that riot. And then the tensions persisted all the way through the 60s, where there were neighborhood vigilante groups trying to prevent African Americans from moving into different neighborhoods. And Detroit had this... it was both a very diverse city and also a very tense place in terms of that diversity.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about other figures who loom large and take on housing discrimination, because one of the problems that became a huge problem down the road, and it started then. But George Romney was a real champion, and I think that he, at one point you write about his being in a demonstration in favor of fair housing, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. George Romney was a moderate Republican who was pretty strong on civil rights. And in that summer of 63, there was he didn't participate in the Walk to Freedom with Martin Luther King. And he said the reason he didn't is because it was on a Sunday, and he didn't do anything public on Sundays as a Mormon. But not long after that, there was a march in protest of housing discrimination in Grosse Pointe, one of the elite suburbs of Detroit. There was something called the Grosse Pointe point system, which is a really hideous, insidious way of keeping out people that the establishment didn't want to live there. They had a sort of a secret point system where they'd deduct against people if they were of a different color of skin or from Eastern Europe or Jewish. And it persisted for a long time, and Romney participated in a march protesting that, both the point system and the in favor of open housing laws in the area and in the whole state.
And tell us more about housing discrimination and white flight. In 63, did a good portion of the white population move into the suburbs? Were the freeways built then, David?
Well, Detroit in 1963, the African-American population in the city was about 29%. Over the decades after that, it would increase to, you know, over 80%. But the white flight was starting. It was increased every year and decade after 63. There were already, going back into the late 50s, many antagonistic confrontations where white neighborhoods rallied and organized against any effort by an individual African-American family to move into the neighborhood. There were many, many white neighborhood associations, some of them affiliated with the John Birch Society, that worked vigilantly against any open housing laws. And in 63, that summer, that fall, the first effort to pass an open housing law in Detroit was defeated.
Hmm. Similar to what was happening in Milwaukee, actually, right?
Yes, very much so. And, you know, Detroit is in Milwaukee are similar in many ways, and Detroit is kind of an exaggeration to some extent of the problems that many urban centers faced in that whole area, you know, concerning urban renewal, which many African Americans called Negro removal, the unsettling of traditional neighborhoods, the fight over open housing, the fleeing to the suburbs, the commerce going to the suburbs with suburban malls, all of those different issues every city faced to one degree or another. Detroit just faced them a little more heavily.
It's kind of interesting that it did, isn't it, David? Because you've mentioned and you write at great length about the progressive leadership of the city, people who embraced the civil rights movement.
Well, that yes, but you know, you think about Walter Reuther and how progressive he was in terms of civil rights with the United Auto Workers. Many of his own labor people, you know, the workers, moved to the suburbs and ended up voting for George Wallace not long after that. So he was really ahead of many of his people during that period. And you know, that race is still the great dilemma of America, in my opinion, and, mm-hmm. and it still has those divides.
Mm-hmm. What about Ford? What about Henry Ford II? What kind of guy was he in 1963, and did he run the company in a more in a fairer way than his grandfather?
Well, Henry Ford II, known as the Deuce, was a very flamboyant figure himself, kind of not unlike Reverend Franklin in many ways. He was very colorful. He was leaving his wife for an Italian jet setter during that period. He uttered the famous phrase, never explain, never complain. He was not his grandfather in other ways, in any way, and some of the ways he wasn't were very positive. His grandfather was a virulent anti-Semite.
Yeah.
Very much, propounding the notion that Jews were responsible for all the problems in the world. You know, just awful in that regard. And the Deuce, when he took over, Henry Ford II, worked very hard to try to overcome that legacy of his grandfather. He also was, he didn't love labor or Reuther, but he was much more accommodating to the practicality of dealing with labor and its importance to the auto industry and to Detroit. And so he actually was responsible for labor peace during much of that period, not all of it, but much of it. He was feeling very optimistic in 1964 at the end of my book, so much so that he endorsed Lyndon Johnson for president, the first Ford ever to support a Democrat.
Hmm. What year did the Mustang come out, David?
The Mustang comes out in April of 1964 at the New York World's Fair. It was called the 1964 and a half Mustang. It was in development for all of the period of my book, and much of it was in secret. You know, Lee Iacocca was then a vice president and president at Ford, and he was helping push the Mustang with his engineers. And J. Walter Thompson, the largest advertising agency in the nation, had an office in downtown Detroit that they called the Tomb, where they were plotting the marketing campaign for the new car that would be the largest automobile marketing campaign in history.
Hmm. My dad had one of those. It just came to mind just now. It was yellow, convertible. Black,
Crisis car.
Yeah, exactly. That would have been the time that he had it. I kind of like that. I think I learned to drive on that car too. It was kind of
they were cool in that period.
Yeah, we should have kept that baby, huh? Yeah. Let's go to more phone calls. Allison in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I was also born in Detroit, not until 1967, like 6 weeks before the riot in the end of July. And my question is about Grace Lee Boggs and Jimmy Boggs. I wondered if they showed up in your book at all, Mr. Marinus?
Just barely. And as part of the Grace Lee was, for people who don't know, was a very activist organizer, as was her husband during that period. They're in the movement that starts at the end of my book among African Americans who were trying to start a new Freedom Party in Detroit. So she is mentioned. She's not a major character in the book, but I certainly know all about her.
That's great that she's included in there. Thank you so much.
And what are your memories of Detroit, Allison? Good ones?
Well, my family moved 14 miles north to the suburbs near Birmingham, Michigan, when I was, very small, I think, right when my dad got back from a trip after the riots.
Wow.
And so the relationship that my family had with Detroit, though, was a little bit different because we spent time downtown still. My parents are not American, and we would still go downtown like it was the cultural center of our greater community. And my dad worked for Chrysler at many different locations in Detroit. And so I remember it in ways that maybe, some of my peers might not if they had not, had a family like that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks so much for your call. John in Michigan. Hi, John. Are you there, John? Whoopsie, John, call us back. Our number is 800-486-8655. David Marinus is our guest this hour. He has a new book, Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story. David is author of many other books, When Pride Still Mattered, A Life of Vince Lombardi. He is the author of First in His Class, A Biography of Bill Clinton, Rome 1960, The Olympics That Stirred the World, Barack Obama, The Story, Clemente, The Passion and Grace of Baseball's Last Hero, They Marched Into Sunlight, War and Peace, Vietnam in America, October 1967. David is an associate editor at the Washington Post and a Pulitzer Prize winner as well. And so we're particularly interested in many of you. Our calls have been from people who were born in Detroit and grew up in Detroit. Those are interesting, but there are comparisons, as David said, with Milwaukee as well, other industrial cities of the North. Detroit just brought together this great, great cast of characters in 1963 that, and you look at the auto industry and what's happening with the labor movement and what's happening with music and the civil rights movement, which makes it a very, very interesting year to examine, which David does. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily. Motown, of course, was big then, so we're playing a little bit of Motown as well to, well, because why not play Motown? Is our guest. Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story is what we're talking about. The year is 1963. How old did you say little Stevie Wonder was in 63?
He was 12 and 13.
Huh. And there's a picture of him in the book, isn't there? He's playing the harmonica?
Yeah, he's playing the harmonica. Yeah, he came to Detroit from Saginaw. He went to the school for the blind there. And he was a friend of one of the brothers of a member of the Miracles, and who recommended him to Berry Gordy. And he played like 8 instruments, the drums and harmonica in particular. And Gordy saw something special in him, and Stevie took off. His first big hit came during the period of my book. It was Fingertips Part 2, sort of a thrilling, crazy song where Stevie, when he performed it live, they'd have to drag him off the stage. He didn't want to go. I sort of likened little Stevie Wonder in that period to a young Cassius Clay before he became Muhammad Ali. They were both sort of rambunctious and boyish, and didn't have the meaning behind them that each of them would develop in such important ways later in their careers.
Hmm. Let's get more calls for you, David. Brian in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hey.
Hey, Brian.
So I'm really enjoying this. I've been a Motown fan all my life. One thing I haven't heard yet is any kudos to the Funk Brothers.
Oh, the Funk Brothers were crucial. They were the studio band for Motown. They're in my book. Most of them are gone, but I interviewed a few, including Paul Reiser, who played the trombone. And they were a rambunctious group of their own. They were mostly jazz musicians and blues musicians who came out of the club scene in Detroit. A lot of them played at the Flame Show Bar, from Benny Benjamin to Jamerson. All of them were just great musicians who were really sort of one of the keys to the to Motown's success and really underappreciated at the time.
Hmm. Thanks, Brian. And what did it do for the city? It just in terms of, you know, your everyday life, because Motown was taken off all over the country, would you go into the drugstore and they'd be playing a little bit of Aretha or Stevie Wonder or one of these performers? Did it infuse itself into the life of the city somehow?
Oh, absolutely. And Detroit already had that infusion. Aretha, by the way, was not part of Motown because her preacher father thought she was better than Motown, so she went to New York City and made it there. But she was definitely close friends with Smokey Robinson from a very early age and with many of the other Motown artists. But they all talk about how music was such a key part of their lives growing up anyway that there were these groups forming just on the sidewalks in high school. You know, everybody had a group that they were singing with. It was just part of the culture there. And so then when Motown came along, it just accentuated it. And many other people in Detroit that I interviewed for the book talked about the songs that most influenced them during that period. It was all Motown all the time.
Hmm. Brian, thanks. Sam in Madison, hi. Hey there, Sam.
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead.
David, I grew up near the Rouge plant and went to Fortson High School. The Arab American community is a very large one. How do you see that they have influenced the growth of Detroit in recent years?
Well, thanks for asking that. You're absolutely right. That's mostly in Dearborn in the southwest corner of Detroit, a huge Arab population. The first character I introduced in my book was a kid who grew up near Patton Park, right on the edge of the Rouge Plant, and would play hooky and go to the Rouge Plant all the time. And he talked a lot about the Arab population there. It's changed over the years, interestingly enough. In that era, it was a lot of Lebanese and Syrians, and now it's Yemeni who are in Dearborn, and the other Arabs have moved out further into the suburbs. But it's been a very important part of the population of Detroit over many years, and it's probably made Detroit more understanding of the issues of Arab Americans and Muslim culture than other parts of the country.
Hmm. And what about Detroit on the national stage? A lot of the leaders that you write about had ties, and some of them very close ties, to people who were so prominent in so many important movements, friends of Dr. Martin Luther King, JFK, others, Democrats. If you were running for president, you had to go to Detroit pretty early on, didn't you?
Oh, absolutely. Most of the Democratic campaigns for president began in Detroit on Labor Day in Cadillac Square with Walter Reuther at your side. That's how Kennedy began his campaign in 1960. And interestingly enough, Kathleen, you know, just as King sort of tried out his I Have a Dream speech in Detroit first, Kennedy tried out his Ask Not famous inaugural phrase in Detroit. He didn't start the sentence with Ask Not. That was more poetic, and that's what Theodore Sorensen probably had him do. But he raised that same question, you know, don't ask what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country, in Detroit on Labor Day as he campaigned for president.
Hmm. So if it plays in Detroit, it's going to be a big hit elsewhere, right? 1963.
Yeah.
Lyndon Johnson's commencement address to the University of Michigan in 64, that was big too.
Yeah, you know, first they had invited President Kennedy to give that address, but of course he was gone by then, assassinated in November of 63, and this was May of 64. LBJ decided to go to Ann Arbor. That's where my book ends. He landed in Detroit at the airport, declared Detroit the herald of hope for America and the engine of the economy, and then took a helicopter to Ann Arbor and delivered the Great Society address. Sort of a wistful moment of what the hopes were, and you know, the reader knows what was to come, but the people involved didn't at that point.
Mm-hmm. You, and the focus of the book is a glory time for Detroit, but obviously you can't talk about that without thinking about what's happened to Detroit in recent years. You say, David, that Detroit's comeback now has to somehow figure out how to improve the school system and also how to improve the lives with good jobs that pay very decently for the African-American population.
Yeah, and those are really difficult problems.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Detroit is on the comeback trail. You can feel it every time I go there. There's a little more energy. Definitely some major investors have invested in the downtown, and it's thriving. Of course, they want to make money off it. They're placing a investment gamble on it. But that seems to be working. And in the Midtown area, which is near Wayne State University and the Art Institute, a lot of young people are flooding into that area. It's the place to go. It's kind of like a new Brooklyn, although, you know, they don't like to be compared to Brooklyn. It's kind of a cliche. But anyway, foodies and techies and artists and all kinds of kids are coming there after college and really inventing their lives in Detroit. And it's a huge but. You know, Detroit was built on a working middle class, and that, you know, the housing, there's the house that I lived in when I was 6 years old, it was torn down, and five of the eight houses on that block are gone.
Mm.
And there are wide swaths of Detroit that are just like that, and the jobs for those people are not there.
Mm. So did you think about maybe putting a little house down somewhere in Detroit again?
Well, I can't have to, you know, my other place is Madison, Wisconsin,
right.
I'm coming back to Detroit a lot. I can't live everywhere, but I certainly have a deep affection for Detroit.
Yeah, it's too bad you can't live everywhere, right?
Right.
So you're doing a book signing thing this week. That should be something, huh?
Yeah, I'm going to be in Detroit Wednesday through Saturday.
Oh.
I'll be back three other times over the course of the next couple of months. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And I was there a week and a half ago with one of your NPR colleagues, Kai Rizdahl.
Oh.
And that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Interviewed right outside of where my house used to stand.
Mm. Did it make you kind of sad when you saw it was all gone?
It did. It was also pretty interesting because later that day I went back with a photographer from the Detroit Free Press, and there were police officers walking and patrolling the neighborhood with a certain vigilance, and it turned out there was a drug bust going on houses away while we were taking the pictures.
Mm. And you're going to be in Milwaukee, where we are, at Centennial Hall, the great library, Central Library, next Thursday. I don't know if you know your schedule, but we know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, I, it's a little dizzying, but I knew I was coming to Milwaukee, and I love that library, and I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Seeing my friends and other people in Milwaukee.
Yeah, it's a great, great library. Thursday, October 8th from 6:30 until 8. Well, you're such a writer. You're so good. You know, you're so involved in it. You get all these details that you're just a really good reporter. I guess it comes from that skill, doesn't it?
Well, thanks. You know, I'm also lucky that I'm incompetent at everything else in life. So I found one thing that I can do, and I love to do it. And I don't separate the research from the writing. I love both equally.
Yeah. Well, I hope you can dance.
I can dance the Motown.
Okay, good. All right, that's good, David. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Kathleen.
Yeah, our pleasure. David Marinus, and the book is Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story. David will be, as we said, at the Central Library in Milwaukee, Central Centennial Hall, beautiful, beautiful building. The whole library is 6:30 until 8 on October 8, and I think that you may want to be there because it'll be a lot of fun. Thanks to Scott Myers for producing the hour. Thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. A little bit more Motown as we say goodbye to you.